The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And in most years, being a member of the Electoral College would probably get you a nice plaque thanking you for your service at best. But on this first Monday after the second Wednesday in December, the Constitution says electors shall now cast their votes for president and vice president. And there may be a lot more than a symbolic plaque at stake for these 538 electors. Many of them will be traveling to their state capital for the vote throughout the day. Lee Snover is an elector from Pennsylvania, and she says her mind is in something of a swirl because, like a lot of other electors, she's being lobbied by the American people to vote against Donald J. Trump. She's getting mail from all over the country.
White Plains, New York, Philadelphia, PA, Doylestown, Media, PA, Clifton, New Jersey, Herndon, Virginia, Wilmington, Delaware.
All mail from the American people who believe that this electoral college is a last-ditch workaround to save us from what they fear from a Trump presidency.
Do you think I'm going to be angry getting this?
I love this.
You know? So I'm not upset. These are Americans, right? It doesn't bother me that they're sending me the mail. And I actually like these ones, the individual handwritten ones. I actually like to read them. Dear Mrs. Snover, I'm writing to you as a concerned Pennsylvanian. I respectfully urge you to use your constitutional right not to cast your vote for Donald Trump to the office of the presidency on December 19th. Do you have the fun one where someone offered me cake and a hug? No, I did really love that. This lack of experience, conflicts of interest, and temperament are enough to question his capacity to lead our democracy. Now see, this is a beautiful Christmas card. It's from Los Angeles, California. Isn't that nice? Dear elector, there is a path to putting a Republican in the White House who is not Donald Trump. A Trump presidency will bring dangerous instability to our country. I'm not sure if they are legitimate concerns, but the fact that these people believe they're legitimate, I can understand that. Please consider this letter as an earnest plea to carry out your constitutional duty to exercise your independent and well-reasoned judgment before casting your electoral vote. The founders did not create the Electoral College as a rubber stamp. You are the country's checks and balances. You are in the only position to ensure that the office of the president is filled by a person who is qualified. The 12th Amendment exists for a reason. Please have the courage to exercise your constitutional obligation.
We are a fly on the wall here as Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick visited Snover in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania over the weekend.
I first met Lee Snover back in July at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. A lifelong Republican from Pennsylvania, a delegate, owner of a construction business, you know, she felt a sense of connection with Donald Trump, his business background and his brashness. And we kept in touch. Since then, I was with her on election night in Pennsylvania when Donald Trump shocked the world. Now, Lee has been credited with flipping Northampton County in Pennsylvania, north of Philadelphia, to Republican for the first time since 1988. And now, Lee Snover is one of 20 electors from Pennsylvania. She's headed to Harrisburg today to cast her vote. The mail's been pouring into her home, to her work, her inbox, by the tens of thousands, people beggingly to vote for pretty much anyone but Donald Trump. I paid a visit to Lee Snover at her home in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, to talk to her about the Electoral College, her responsibilities, and even some of her disappointments with the president-elect that she worked so hard to send to the White House.
Originally, when I was getting the mail, the first few weeks I was getting the mail, it was more focused on Hillary Clinton. I want you to vote for Hillary Clinton. Now it's not focusing on Hillary Clinton. It's, we'll take anyone but Trump. We'll even take another Republican. It transitioned. In the beginning, it was, please vote for Hillary, please vote for Hillary. Some are still saying that, but most of it now transitioned to just do not vote for Donald Trump.
Let's get it on the record here, Lee. You're an elector. Are you supporting Donald Trump in the Electoral College?
Yes, I will support Donald Trump in the Electoral College. Very different reasons, or very different than when I was a delegate. My support for him as a delegate at the convention was about the man, about him being larger than life, about changing the country, about how I felt about him. My vote in the Electoral College is different. For me, that's carrying out the will of Pennsylvania, the Constitution, and memorializing the election. I see it very different. I'm not going down to vote for this man doing the thank you tours who's larger than life. I'm going down to vote the will of the Pennsylvania voter.
So I want to talk about that first part a little bit, because we had a conversation a few days ago that was a different conversation about Donald Trump than I've had with you since the moment I met you back in the summer. It was a different version of how you were viewing Donald Trump now before he takes office than you used to.
Right.
And I'm interested in how you're feeling about him now, how he's been performing as president-elect, and how you've been sort of observing and digesting that.
You know, I'm still a huge fan and supporter of Donald Trump. I mean, I would never deny that because, again, he stands for a lot of things I stand for. We're very similar in some ways. However, I'm not fond of the thank you tours. I just feel I want you to be more formal and more about the job, which I think he is doing with the transition. But I don't like the thank you tours. I don't like it.
You had suggested that continuing with rallies at this point instead of like going to a nursing home or something,
yes,
just wasn't appropriate.
Yes, absolutely. It's the holidays. For me, a thank you tour would be Donald Trump walking into Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and greeting some families and wishing them well, or going to a senior center and visiting them and bringing them joy. Because you know, whether you supported him or not, it's still exciting to meet Donald Trump. Or, you know, going into a diner or where regular people are and greeting them. To me, that's a thank you. The rallies are fine and they're rah-rah, but that's a campaign and that's over. Just like I'm telling these people in the letter, I feel like I need to tell the Trump supporters the same message. The election's over. Everyone go back to work. Move along, folks. There's nothing to see here. He needs to be serious. He needs to be formal. He needs to do his job.
You had also expressed some disappointment about the cabinet and some of the choices, the difference between who he's intended to nominate versus supporters throughout the campaign. People like, I think you mentioned, Newt Gingrich or Rudy Giuliani or loyalists. And when we talked a couple of days ago, you seemed pretty disappointed about the makeup of some of the cabinet.
It's funny, though, because I think he's doing exactly what he said he would do, and I'm just not getting my way. So I kind of need to accept that and, you know, let that go. But, you know, he said he wasn't going to be political and he wasn't going to reward political favors. So I kind of need to accept that. But I must tell you, when I look at the cabinet and I don't see Newt and I don't see Rudy and I don't see Huckabee, I start to wonder about loyalty. You know what I mean? Like, that's big for me. And why is Kanye West up in Trump Tower instead of me? That's the kind of thank you I want to see. I want to see more loyalty to the people who made serious sacrifices for this gentleman to get elected.
What's the most convincing or the best argument or the best letter, the best card that you've gotten?
If there was anything that possibly, you know, that has struck me is maybe the conflict of interest stuff. That might be the only thing that only because I was reading that stuff about Ivanka being, you know, involved with China and just stuff like that.
Well, talk about that a little bit, because it's these concerns about, you know, whether it's an electoral college issue or not. These concerns about Donald Trump have been growing because of all of his business interests in these countries where he's going to be making decisions, mm-hmm. right? He's got the national interest and he's got business, personal interest, and these things might be.
Right. Well, you know what? I'm pro-business, so I do not have a problem with a businessman being president. So what I don't want to do is tie him to where we don't elect business people, because I don't want to be limited to only electing people that are from the government. But at the same time, I think we carefully need to make sure all his business dealings are either in the blind trust or fully in the hands of his children. And I mean fully in the hands of his children. I would like to see it all in Don Jr.'s hands, every bit of it.
There have been concerns from constitutional lawyers that because of the nature of Donald Trump's business in countries, pick it, Bahrain, UAE, Philippines, where some of the businesses that he deals with as a businessman are government either run or government invested, that he may be in violation of the Constitution if any payments are made while he's president, whether he knows about it or not, because of the emoluments clause, right? The president may not take a payment from a foreign government at all, and that's going to be bad for Donald Trump if he winds up in a constitutional situation.
Right. You know? Yeah, I know. That's why I think it needs to be dealt with ahead of time, and I think it can be resolved. I'm not saying that, you know, he can't be president because he has this business before he ran. I mean, I think of the Clinton Foundation. I mean, every time someone talks about Donald Trump's conflicts of interest, I think about all the countries and leaders that were contributing to them. So, you know, not that it was right then, it's not going to be right now, but I think we have a chance to do something about it before he's inaugurated, and I do want to do something about it.
Donald Trump is a politician now. Maybe different from other politicians, but he's run for office, he's won, he's taken money, he's making political promises. What do you need to see in the first 100 days to verify that he's the real deal?
Legislation. And not forming a committee to talk about it. I don't want to hear that. I want to see major tax reform. I don't want them to tell me, oh, tax reform is too challenging, we're not going to get to it. Or tax reform is not going to be bold like the 1980s. I had better see a return to 1986, 1988, that kind of pro-business environment where we got to keep more of what we earned, where we could pass it on to our children. And I want to see movement on the Affordable Care Act, some movement. I mean, I don't want anyone who has insurance to be uninsured. But I do think that we can make changes to that, to improvement, and I think we can do that more easily than what they're telling us. But my biggest thing is, I want a better economy than my parents had. My father had the business I had in the 1980s. It was so much more lucrative, and he didn't work as near as hard as I do. And now I have his business, and I work, I would say, twice the hours he does. I do twice the millions of dollars in gross sales, and I have nothing the net that he did. There was less regulation. He didn't need, I mean, the tax forms I have to do for the business and the healthcare forms and the affidavits and the time I got to spend in meetings on that. My father didn't have that. You know, he was the pickup truck and the hammer, and he made a lot more money than I'm making growing his business. I've grown his business in leaps and bounds. But I don't have what he had. He was able to buy 3 houses. I'm not able to do that off the same company he had. So in the 80s, there was a lot less regulation. Workers' comp was not, you know, this huge and cumbersome burden on construction companies. It's just so changed. And it's so difficult to have a lucrative business anymore.
That was Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick talking with Pennsylvania elector Lee Snover. Lee Snover is voting today in Pennsylvania's capital, Harrisburg. There's another confrontation going on in North Carolina that pits party against the people. North Carolina elected a Democratic governor in November, ousting incumbent North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory. But this past Friday, McCrory, after a special legislative session, was able to sign into law a number of measures limiting the power of the incoming governor, Roy Cooper. Greer Martin is a Democratic member of the North Carolina House of Representatives, representing District 34. Greer Martin, who does this hurt?
In the end, this hurts the people of North Carolina who have elected a Democratic governor. I expect a lot of the people of our state have voted for both Democrats and Republicans, hoping for some kind of system of checks and balances and a balance of power. And this hurts them because it's a blatant power grab by one side of the political spectrum to shift away from that balance of power.
What will it take away from the governor's office?
Several things. There's legislation that would take away from the governor the ability to point to the state board of election and our local county boards of elections a majority of his party. This is something that both Democratic and Republican governors have enjoyed. In its place, there's a system now that would essentially, in the key election years, mostly the even-numbered years when there's presidential, gubernatorial, and congressional elections, control of the state board of election and county boards of elections to Republican chairs. That's particularly troubling in the context of a lot of the voter suppression legislation that was passed in North Carolina recently that courts have overturned. The Republicans have demonstrated their willingness and desire to target African-American voters, and this measure that has been signed by Governor McCrory will continue to give them the power to do that.
So it puts the election boards in the hands of Republicans. And that's out of reach of the legislature, at least from what I understand of what you're saying. Are the election boards able to influence the districting process as well?
They're not able to influence the redistricting process. Now, note that it is under the guise of bipartisanship where the chairs will alternate between the parties, but every crucial election year it'll be under Republican control. The redistricting is a separate problem, and that's the districts that we ran in, the General Assembly that was elected, that passed all this legislation, is elected in, from districts that have already been ruled by the courts to be unconstitutional. So that's a separate knot that we in North Carolina are going to have to untangle.
There was a protest here, and a number of arrests were accompanied the special session. And there have been confrontations between people and party in North Carolina for months this year. How are all of these protests related, and can anything be done to reverse what's already happened?
The General Assembly came into, quote unquote, emergency session to pass all these egregious acts. We can always call ourselves back into session to repeal them and perhaps even to make some improvements to the way we do business in North Carolina. So nothing is stopping us from doing that except for the lack of political will in the majority party that's consolidated their power now and wants to probably, I'm afraid, continue down that path.
Can any state do this? Can any state call a emergency session and essentially make an incoming incumbent of the opposite party powerless?
It is going to depend on the individual state constitutions and statutes. So I can't speak for all 50 states. But my concern is that the power grab that in North Carolina has been accomplished by the Republicans sets a model for both parties around the state. You know, I don't want to pretend that there's something in the Republican DNA that makes them particularly susceptible to want to seize power. That's something I'd say more is in the DNA of whatever party is in power. So the Republicans in North Carolina are setting a bad example that I sure hope that Democrats and Republicans in the other 49 states will choose not to follow.
And this is the frustration. I mean, I think people in North Carolina at the end of this are going to feel more out of reach, that this is a battle going on between elites in North Carolina, and it has maybe less to do with the people and their representation, whether they're African-American or a white American, and that it has much more to do with the backstory that ultimately doesn't represent any voter.
Sure. I think if there's anything that we can learn from the election of 2016, on which the dust is still settling, but the campaigns of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and many other insurgent candidates, is that the people in our country and the people in North Carolina do not feel that the system represents them. And power grabs like this certainly just feed into that perception. Instead, we need to be looking at ways to make it easier for people to vote. I refer to the voter suppression legislation in North Carolina that made it harder for African Americans and Democrats to vote. The ideal is that we make it easier for all North Carolinians, all Americans, to cast a ballot, regardless of our prediction as to which party they're going to cast. Only by reforming the way that we draw our districts are we going to start to chip away at the problem of public confidence in our political system.
Representative Greer Martin, I'm just wondering what it is you do now. Do you think the entire election is challengeable because a federal court has ruled some of the districts unconstitutional that were gerrymandered here?
This election will not be overturned, but the courts have already ordered that a large portion of the General Assembly seats be up for election in 2017, a very unusual thing. Normally, we're just elected in even-numbered years. But because the districts are unconstitutional, the courts felt it was unconscionable for the people of North Carolina to be represented by members elected from unconstitutional districts any further. So that'll be a start. We'll have districts that I don't know that I go so far as to say that they're fair, but they'll be less unfair. And then I think what we need to do is pass the bill out of the General Assembly that actually has passed the North Carolina House under Republican control with strong bipartisan support to create a bipartisan redistricting commission. That will ensure that the districts are not drawn by those of us in the legislature who have the most to gain from them. And that'll be a start both in restoring balance to North Carolina politics and also in restoring the faith of the public in our political system.
Representative Greer Martin is a Democrat representing District 34 in North Carolina. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It appears that Rex Tillerson, current CEO of ExxonMobil and President-elect Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of State, made his way to the top of ExxonMobil by becoming a director of a U.S.-Russian oil firm based in the tax haven the Bahamas. Leaked documents reported by The Guardian show Tillerson as instrumental in setting up deals that are currently on hold due to Western-imposed sanctions. All this isn't illegal, but it all seems at odds to Trump's America First rhetoric that he expressed throughout the campaign. Luke Hardig is a senior international correspondent for The Guardian. Luke, is this a contradiction in Tillerson's resume and Donald Trump's rhetoric?
Well, I think it makes things harder, tougher for him ahead of a kind of confirmation hearing by the Senate, because clearly there's a massive conflict of interest here. This is someone who's been in the oil industry for four decades, who's worked extensively in Russia, and whose deals in Russia are now on hold because of U.S. sanctions. And now we have this leaked document, which we have just published, showing that he was the director of a U.S.-Russian company called Exxon Nefty Gas Limited, with directors in Houston, directors in Moscow, directors in the Far East of Russia. And of course, it's based in Bermuda, which is notorious for its secrecy, and a tax haven to boot, which sits oddly with the whole premise, as you say, of America First.
Is this the hint of Tillerson possibly setting up a company that would meet the criteria of the Russian oligarchs that they were probably investing along with in the Russian oil deal?
Well, it's a joint venture, but what I found very odd is that actually this company, Exxon Nefty Gas, which is basically Exxon's kind of interest in the Russian Federation, its actual area of activities is in one of the most remote places in the world. It's called Sakhalin, on the Pacific Far East coast of Russia, where Exxon, working together with kind of Russian oil companies, has built a massive platform and is already extracting oil. And yet the company, according to the document we've got, is actually officially, at least, registered 10,000 kilometers away in the sort of semi-tropical Bahamas. So first of all, there's something rather contrived about this. And secondly, it just speaks to the problem that Rex Tillerson faces, because the other major ExxonMobil project in Russia is in the Arctic, where the company is exploring jointly with Rosneft, which is a Russian state oil company run by Igor Sechin, who's Rex Tillerson's friend and Vladimir Putin's friend. Now, drilling there is on hold because of U.S. sanctions. And of course, as Secretary of State, one of the first decisions Tillerson will have to make if he's confirmed is will the U.S. continue with sanctions against Russia, or will it drop them? And of course, the Trump administration has signaled that it will probably drop them, which would obviously massively boost Exxon, boost its share price, and also help Rex Tillerson's own portfolio of stocks. And though he may divest himself of all this, I think he has to under U.S. law. Clearly, it's something of a mess.
As far as Trump is concerned, he's obviously familiar with these kinds of tax havens in Bermuda, right?
Well, I mean, that's a big question about Trump, his money, about links with Russia. There have been all sorts of rumors. There's been very little hard proof. Obviously, we haven't seen Trump's tax returns. But what we can say definitively, I've been in touch with Exxon over the last couple of days, is that from these leaked documents, we published one, but there are others. It's clear that Exxon has this massive offshore footprint. And you might say, well, a lot of, you know, Fortune companies do the same thing. Well, that may be true, but their CEOs don't go on to be America's most senior diplomat.
And does it jive with Donald Trump's America First campaign rhetoric? Offshore companies are what he's railing against specifically.
Well, it kind of looks like Bahamas first and Russia second and America some point after that. Now, Exxon does say, well, we pay tax. I haven't checked the numbers, but they claim they meet all of their legal obligations. But it looks odd at a time of austerity, not just in the US, but across most of the world generally, that you have a very, very, very profitable corporation that's doing slightly opaque deals with Russia and that is seemingly kind of at one step away from the regular American tax system, which you and I pay into.
Luke Hardig is a senior international correspondent for The Guardian. Thanks so much, Luke.
Thank you.
The cycle of policy in the criminal justice system seems to be shifting away from inflexible punishment sentences intended to deter crime by their severity alone. Following a generation of successful law and order political leaders, bloated inmate populations have finally begun to decline. In 2014, there were 1.5 million prisoners nationally, down about 1% from the year before. And in some states, such as New York and California, there's been as much as a 20% decline. How much more could those numbers be reduced? Well, if concerns are with public safety and whether sending inmates to jail makes them a danger to the community, the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU Law School says many, many more could be considered for release. Inimai Chettiar is director of the Brennan Center's justice program. She says vengeful sentencing laws have overemphasized the importance of criminal victims against the community's safety.
So we sought to answer the question of how many people are incarcerated without a public safety rationale. And the finding was that 39% of current prisoners could likely be released without any public safety risk, which is an astonishing finding.
How do you determine that they're not a safety risk?
We looked at all of the people in state and federal prison and looked at the seriousness of the crime committed, the victim impact, the intent for every crime, and realized that for one large set of folks, 25% of the prison population, they had committed lower level offenses that could be better punished with treatment, parole, or probation, electronic monitoring. I mean, I think that there is a sense that prison is the only way to treat crimes, and I think that's what we're trying to break through on.
How much does the prison system cost, and how much does the, I guess, infrastructure of rehab and treatment that you envision as an alternative, how much would that cost in trying to deal with these people on a sort of one-to-one basis?
So the criminal justice system now overall costs about $260 billion. $80 billion of that is incarceration. Treatment is far cheaper, as is probation or electronic monitoring.
Does prison turn people who aren't risks to public safety into people who are risks to public safety, according to your research?
Yeah, that's one of the large problems of the current prison system, is that the assumption was that if you sent someone to prison, you would actually reduce crime. And you actually find, in some cases, the opposite. So particularly for lower level offenders, when you send them to prison, they actually often end up leaving prison with a higher recidivism rate than if they had gone to an alternative program.
In the sense they leave with aspects of their personality which make them more likely to be rearrested.
Yeah, I think there's two aspects. One is what prison does to someone can often increase their recidivism rate. That's what sociologists call the criminogenic effect of prison. The second thing is when we release people from prison, we largely don't provide any reentry services. So you're taking someone out of society for years and then kind of dropping them back without providing proper job support or education support.
So what do you envision as a best case scenario in the sort of dream criminal justice system that would actually address these questions of public safety and needless prison sentences, in your view?
So what we're recommending is that state legislatures and Congress change their sentencing laws so that grounded in sentencing is the idea that an alternative such as treatment or probation or electronic monitoring would be the default sentence for low-level offenses. The second recommendation that we're making is that it's not true that longer sentences always bring down crime and recidivism, and that there's a diminishing return to sentence lengths. So you could sentence someone to 2 years or 5 years and get the same recidivism or crime reduction as 10 years or 20 years. And so we're also suggesting that they consider reducing sentences perhaps by starting at about 25%.
How much does political sensitivity about certain crimes impede any reform here?
So it's actually surprising. There is an emerging transpartisan consensus that we do need to end mass incarceration. And so even though we have Donald Trump campaigning on law and order, many of the leaders of his party are actually agreeing with the idea that you need to reduce imprisonment. Of course, the first subset to be looked at are the lower level offenders. But I do think that there are a lot of conservative leaders who are focused on the idea of redemption and second chances. And so even if someone has gone away for a serious crime, they are supportive of the idea of at least trying to help them get back on their feet once they get out.
Inimai Chettiar is director of the Brennan Center's justice program. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A faulty ballistics test and an overeager prosecution sent Anthony Ray Hinton to death row in 1985. It took 16 years of fighting by lawyer Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative to get him released.
in April of 2015. Stevenson says the battle for America's soul is now taking place in cases like this in the U.S. criminal justice system.
Over-incarceration and excessive punishment has defined a generation, and it has really stained America in ways that are profound and meaningful and will be long-lasting. And I really don't have difficulty asserting that it's as prominent and important an issue, as worthy a cause, if you will, as anything I can think of. I mean, I see the work that we're doing as really an extension of the work that was being done to overcome slavery, overcome the terrorism of lynching, overcome segregation, because I think the contemporary manifestation of our failure to deal with those issues is the American criminal justice system.
That system kept Anthony Ray Hinton in a 5x7 cell waiting for his execution day for a crime he didn't commit for nearly 30 years. He was sentenced to death after being convicted of the murders of two restaurant managers. Hinton is 59 now. He was 29 at the time of his conviction, and he remembers vividly how he was mowing the lawn at his mother's house in Birmingham on a hot July day when the police showed up.
On that particular day, I was imagining getting through with cutting the grass. It was very hot in July, and going in the house, taking a shower, and later on, my church was having our yearly revival, and that's what I had looked forward to later on that evening, was going to revival and hearing the word of God. But something dramatic happened, and it changed the way I see the justice system. It changed the way I trust people. It just helped scarred me for life. I really believe that.
What did you think that your life would be before the police came to get you? What did you dream of being? What did you imagine you would do?
Well, you know, like I think, like most people, I dream of perhaps getting married, starting a family, just being a productive citizen, and more of all, treat people with respect and dignity. You know, I think it's a tragedy. I think the world passes you by. No one said, we're going to wait on Anthony Ray Hinton and see how his case turned out. The world kept going. All these places kept going. And I just wanted a life that quietness and peaceful and doing my job as a citizen of this country and providing for my family.
And can you describe what life is like on death row?
Oh, it is exactly what it say, death row. You wakes up every morning with a death sentence over your head. For 30 years, I slept in a 5x7 with my knees in a fetal position. Only had a sink and a toilet, and my bed was mounted to the wall. It is constantly noise 24/7. There is nothing hardly ever good come to death row. But the thing that I can actually say, when you hear men tell you why they're there, I think that not only did their parents fail those that didn't provide love and nurturing for them, I think we as a society failed them as well, and we failed them again by sentencing them to death.
Who failed you, Anthony?
The system failed me. The system that I was brought up to believe in. As a little boy, my mom used to always tell me, if you ever lost, try to find a police officer. If you ever need help, find a police officer. They are your friend. And I can remember sitting back watching a little show called Leave It to Beaver, I think it was, and you had this police officer used to be out there on the street directing traffic and showing people which way to go. My mom believed in that. And I believed in it until 1985. I wish I could sit here today and tell you that all polices was like the one that did me, but they're not. There are some good officers out there. There are some good prosecutors out there. There are some people that really believe in the truth. I just happened to run across one that believed that the world should be white, and I believed, ran across one that he was willing to get a conviction at any cost, and that means sending innocent people to death row.
How did you make a full life in your mind when you were on death row? I mean, what did you do inside that head of yours?
Well, you know, it's the first 3 years when I first arrived at death row, I did not speak to a human being for 3 years other than my mother and my best friend when they came to see me. I had this profound hatred for the men that put me there. And all I could do was imagine escaping. And I didn't want to escape to be on the run. I wanted to escape and just come back and choke the life out of those men that did this to me. And after a while, going into my fourth year, since I couldn't escape physically, I decided I would escape mentally. And I looked at my body, and I told my body, I said, the mind is finna to leave you. But I promise you, I will be back to check on you from time to time. And with that, I could just hear my body saying, okay, but make sure you come back and check on me. And when I did escape, of all the places that I escaped to, I went to England. For whatever reason, I wanted to talk to the Queen. And I showed up at the palace, and I told the guard that I was there to see Queen Elizabeth. I was able to get into the palace, and I saw Queen Elizabeth, and we had a conversation for hours. And after that, talking to the Queen, I realized then that I was able to take my mind and go wherever I wanted to go.
What did the Queen tell you?
Well, we sit down and we talked about Prince Di, and we talked about Prince Charles and Prince Harris and Prince William. And in that conversation, the Queen, she said, Mr. Hinton, would you like some tea? And I said, well, of course I would like some tea. And she said, what would you like in your tea? And I said, a spot of lemon, please. And she summoned the butlers to go and get this lemon for my tea. We come back and we begin to talk more about problems in both worlds. And what I learned then, that I had reached out to a lady that didn't know me, but she didn't turn me away. And I reached out to a lady that had compassion. And in that same breath, I realized that I was helping this lady, that one would think that she had the whole world in her hand, but she was lonely. And she welcomed my visit. When I got ready to leave, she looked at me, sad. And she said, Mr. Hinton, do you promise to come back? And I told the Queen, well, of course, I would be back. And since I've been out, I haven't seen the Queen, but I have the privilege of going to England twice. Got a chance to go into the palace, and hopefully I will get a chance to meet the Queen. There is no way one can spend 30 years in this small cell and not be able to escape somehow, some way. Those that wasn't able to escape either hung themselves or they tried to kill themselves. Man, I don't believe was built to spend 30 years inside of a cage. And I would like for those that are listening to just try to imagine being locked up in a 5x7 for 30 years for something you know you didn't do, something that the authority know that you didn't do. So I was not going to give up. My faith would not let me give up. So I had to find a way to escape, and I escaped where it was beautiful, to places that I never would be able to go, even as a free man. I went to everywhere that I could think of, Japan, Singapore, I went to Spain. I mean, wherever I wanted to go, I allowed my mind to take me there. And now I truly understand what it means to read a book. I may not never go to California, but if you can just give me a book, if I can find a book that talks about California, I can read that book and I can imagine being in California. That's how I did my 30 years.
Who's most responsible for you being free today, do you think?
Well, God Almighty is the one that is responsible. You know, while there for 30 years, I came across a scripture. In this scripture, in Mark 11:24, it said, what things soever you desire when you pray, believe in them and you shall have them. I prayed not for my freedom. I prayed that God will let the truth come out. I prayed that God would send me someone that believed in me. And he sent me, in my honest opinion, the best lawyer in the United States, Mr. Bryan Stevenson. And the moment Mr. Bryan Stevenson shook my hand, I knew without a doubt that God had sent me his very best. And he worked diligently for 16 long years. going back and forth, presenting new evidence, only to be turned down by the attorney general. I had three attorney general just refused to look at the ballistic one more time. One that now is a federal judge, Bill Pryor. He was the first one that I went to and presented this new evidence. And he said, and I quote, "It would be a waste of the taxpayer money to reexamine those bullets for 1 hour. I am convinced that the right man is on death row. A jury of his peers sentenced him and found him guilty. I refused to test those bullets." And with that, he was promoted to a federal judgeship, a lifetime appointment. And for those three gentlemen whose job is to make sure that they are executing the right person, they let not only me down, they let the people of Alabama down, they let the justice system down, and they have not, to this day, had to pay a price for not doing their job. But I spent 30 years on Alabama death row, 16 long years extra after the truth came out. They refused to look at the truth. The system is not there the way people think they are. I want everybody that, under the sound of my voice, to understand one thing. That lady that we call justice, that blindfold that she has on, she can see. She see what race you are. She see how much money you have. She see what college you went to. And when she add all of these things up, she have already found you guilty or not guilty before you entered her courtroom. And I was found guilty before I entered her courtroom.
What's life been like since 2015 in April when you were released?
Well, to be honest with you, I have my good days and my bad days. I still wake up every morning around 2:45 expecting breakfast, because on death row they feed you every morning at 3 a.m. And I'm one that once I get up, I can't go back to sleep. My mind tends to wander back on death row. I shower sometime every other day like I did on death row. Being able to go outside is sometimes I have to pinch or catch myself and tell myself that I'm free. I don't have to wait and ask anyone, can I do this or can I go here or wherever. I've had some good days. I've had some days where I really felt alive and I felt whole again. But then at that same moment, it don't take nothing to re-trickle my mind back that I spent 30 years on Isle of Death Row in a cage. And I don't think a year and a half will undo what 30 years have done to me.
I just find myself so angry listening to your story. And how would you, what would you tell me? I mean, I want to go and get your revenge. What's your advice?
Revenge is mine, said the Lord. One day, the true revenge will come to those that played a part in sending me to death. I do not hate these men that did this to me. I once did. But you know, no one in the state of Alabama to this day have come up to me and say, "Mr. Hinton, I'm sorry." No governor, no legislator. I haven't been given not one dime from the state of Alabama. And they took 30 years of my life. They haven't even had the decency to apologize. But I can't worry about how someone treat me. My mom told me, "You are responsible for how you treat others. You are not responsible for how they treat you." And with that, I get up every morning and I try to smile. I try to bring joy to those that are sad. And not one time did I forgive those men because they asked me to. I forgave those men, not so they can sleep good at night, so I could sleep good at night.
Anthony Ray Hinton spent 30 years on death row before his release in April of 2015. He spoke to us from Birmingham, Alabama. Anthony, thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anthony Ray Hinton lost 30 years of life because of an overzealous criminal justice system. We asked you whether you've changed your mind about criminal punishment policy in recent years.
This is Augusto Modeste in Orlando, Florida. I would have no objections to the death penalty if we lived in a society that truly had blind justice. However, when we can put to death a 14-year-old George Steinie Jr., it makes it difficult to believe in such a system. I am and will forever be opposed to mandatory minimum sentencing, especially since history has shown an inequitably disproportionate tendency towards minorities.
Grand Prairie, Texas, protecting us from us is complicated. Our society seems to be recognizing that fear as a motivation only works if you are afraid. I believe the death penalty and many laws should reflect the environmental aspect of poor behavior, and criminals should be retrained and environmentally reconditioned rather than locked up or put to death. What do you think about the country's criminal justice system right now? Let us know, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or continue the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.